Good morning and good afternoon all. I will leave it another minute or so for everyone to join and then we will start the webinar. Good morning and good afternoon and welcome to the Emerging Market Investors Alliance webinar on carbon credit markets. For the ones in the audience that don't know us, the Alliance is a non-profit founded and run by current and former emerging market professionals. We are an alliance of investors working closely with civil society experts and corporate and sovereign issuers. And our vision is to create a world in which investors take responsibility for the impact of their investments, consistently advocate for sustainability and governance best practices, and transform finance into a powerful force for good governance and sustainability. This webinar is run together by the Carbon Transition Initiative, led by my colleague Pavel Laberco, that you can see in the panel, and by the Sovereign Decarbonization Program that I have been running in the last year and a half at the Alliance. Now, before we start, I'd like to remind the audience that any comments made today are not for quotation or attribution and that press is not allowed. We will leave the last part of the hour to audience questions. So please use the Q&A function at the bottom of the screen and we will address your questions at the end of the panel. Now, during the next hour, we will hear from our experts about the current development of the voluntary carbon markets, but we will also try and understand how the voluntary carbon markets can align with Article 6 of the Paris Agreement, how they can contribute to achieve global net zero. In short, Article 6 allows countries to voluntarily cooperate with one another to achieve the emission reductions targets set on their NDCs, by making it clear that countries can transfer carbon offset internationally to deepen their emission reductions, Article 6 explicitly enables international carbon trading. We will also address the fact that the true nature of projects being funded is very difficult to verify. There are information and data gaps and asymmetries, and the social and environmental impacts of accredited projects vary widely. Several organizations exist to certify VCM credits, such as Verra and Gold Standard, and the Voluntary Carbon Market Integrity Initiative as well is developing guidance for legitimate claims by the offset users. So our panelists that I will very soon introduce can speak to the challenges involved in developing a legitimate and integer market and standards. But let me now introduce you to our panelists. Let's start from Sean. Sean Penrith is the CEO of Gordian Knot Strategies, and Sean is also the Senior Technical Advisor to the Integrity Council for the Voluntary Carbon Market, the ICVCM, an independent governance body aiming to ensure that voluntary carbon markets accelerate a just transition to 1.5 degrees. Sean has traveled a deep trajectory of sustainability and climate change over the past two decades, and he has built both for-profit and non-for-profit organizations around the globe, including being CEO of the Climate Trust Capital and Executive Director of the Climate Trust. Then we have Katia Gorbachuk. She is the Head of Funds of Primary Capital Markets at the London Stock Exchange Group, including the VCM Investment Funds. Katia has over 20 years of experience in international capital markets. And as part of her role, she's responsible for driving the liquidity and the growth of the London funds market into vital sectors of the economy, such as infrastructure, energy transition, and climate change mitigation. And she's also part of the best practice commission of the RI Society. Adam, who is a colleague of Katia, he works as a director in sustainable finance for the London Stock Exchange Group. He has worked with the LSEG to scale up sustainable finance capital markets division, from education on best practices in ESG and climate disclosure to financing the transition and scaling green economy companies and funds. Adrian was part of the team that recently launched the London Stock Exchange Voluntary Carbon Market. And among other roles, he has previously served as the CEO of the international certification body Gold Standards. And last, but certainly not least, Heather McEwen. Heather is a senior manager and project developer engagement at Verra. In her role, Heather provides guidance and support to project developers who utilize the Verra programs, standards, and framework to achieve climate and sustainable development goals. Prior to this role, Heather worked in the energy and carbon industry in the state of Kuwait, where the state of environmental projects were commissioned by the United Nations Compensation Fund for damages incurred during the Iraqi war, and also in South Africa, where she worked on over 50 energy audits for both small and large scale projects. And more recently, she's been assisting local companies with the newly implemented carbon tax, as well as carbon footprinting. So, looking forward to start. Maybe I will start with Sean. Sean, would you mind giving us a broad overview of the carbon markets that they currently are, maybe touching upon the mandatory and voluntary market definition? How can they be instrumental in the net zero achievement? And what do you see as the main challenges for further development? Thank you.
Yeah, happy to. Thank you. Thanks for having us. So basically, the world is divided into two types of carbon pricing instruments. You have compliance or regulatory markets, which in 2021, there was about 64 different carbon pricing instruments covering around 22% of global greenhouse gas emissions. And the compliance market mechanisms are often take the form of either a carbon tax, which Heather's very familiar with, or an emission trading scheme, such as the European Union ETS. And then on the other side, we have the VCM, or the voluntary carbon market, which as the name indicates, is voluntary action governed by a set of rules and procedures by some of the largest leading carbon registries in the world, which includes Verra on this call. The jump in the compliance market from 2020, in which we only had 15% of the global emissions covered, to now 22% in 2021, was largely due to the launch of the China emission trading scheme, which is quite a significant market entry. While there's tremendous momentum, 2022 saw a lot of activity in the early part of the year. That slowed somewhat due to concerns around integrity. A lot of the issue we're facing here is that short-term ambition lags behind what we need to meet the Paris targets. And as a result, our prices are way, way lower than what we need. In fact, only 3.5 or 3.7% of emissions that are covered by some sort of carbon pricing instrument are above $40 per ton. And that's the bottom range of 2020 prices that's recommended for the Paris goals. So we are significantly behind. Of course, the voluntary market has enjoyed a surge, largely due to the increasing number of corporates that have signed up for net zero commitments. So in 2021, we saw the market close at about 1.9 billion compared to 2019, which was $300 million in transactional volume. And we saw this year, because of some issues in the market around press and concerns around the integrity, which I know Adrian's going to talk to as well, we saw 2022 issuances decrease at about 19% for the voluntary carbon market. So this is challenging to the market. We're hoping there are efforts underway, which we'll get into during this webinar, but to try and stabilize that in terms of bringing integrity and confidence and trust and transparency to the market. In terms of corporate climate commitments, at around the midpoint of 2022, we had 3,500 companies that had approved science-based target initiative net zero targets, or they were committed to setting one. And just those companies represented about 1 billion tons of greenhouse gas emissions or reductions, and are projected or were projected to demand around 62 million removal credits by 2050. So fairly significant driver through these corporates setting their net zero targets. In terms of other drivers in volume in the market, we've seen obviously stakeholder pressure on organizations and nations to be much more ambitious. We've also seen a lot of speculative activity. People who are coming in, Gordianaut Strategies advises a number of impact funds around the world, and there's a lot of interest in the space to come in and take a position with the idea of buying low or investing low and selling them high in the future. And then another market force that we saw happen was the bridging of credits into blockchain markets. And so we have crypto carbon activity that's still pretty active. And it actually resulted in about 50 million credits being retired last year. In the voluntary carbon market, you've got all sorts of offset types. So there's about 170 types of credits that range from forest and land use, renewable energy, agriculture, waste disposal, and so on. The leading project developer in the voluntary carbon space is India, followed by the States, and then China. Just a quick point on the size of the market. You know, the Task Force for Scaling the Voluntary Carbon Market came up with some pretty significant numbers in terms of their projections. We like to take the much more modest view that Trove Research predicted, which came out with $10 to $40 billion by 2030, based on prices $20 to $30 a ton, and projections for 2050 from Trove at about $130 to $400 billion. In terms of challenges, and we can talk at length, we've got fragmentation, we've got integrity and quality concerns, we've got transparency concerns, we've got real stakeholder concerns in terms of local communities and equity and justice issues. There's also quite a slew of bad media that's not helping projects. Of course, there are bad projects, but there are also a lot of good projects, and the bad media is certainly putting pause to many of our clients. We transact around 80 million credits a year, and we've seen the pause. There's also a backlog from projects pending approval from two of the leading registries, Verra and the Gold Standard, which saw the backlog rise at about 115% year over year in the third quarter of last year. So that's one of the barriers. And then as we saw in some countries that are parties to the Paris Agreement, some of these countries are putting moratoria in place for issuing forestry or land use credits because they're assessing the impact of these voluntary credits on their ability to meet their nationally determined contribution or their NDC country plans under the Paris Agreement. So there's lots of moving pieces, lots of challenges. Of course, ICBCM, which we're part of or helping support, I guess, and the VCMI, so both supply and demand, are really taking great strides to bring integrity and assurance to the market. It's absolutely vital if we're to stabilize this market and realize the type of projected market demand that we all hope is there. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Sean. A very good intro to all the possible topics we can discuss. And Adrian, I'll now pass it on to you. So Sean has already mentioned some of the pain points of the VCM. Maybe we can have your views on that, especially on the supply side of the market, but also maybe think about the opportunities that they provide to the various stakeholders. And maybe if you can highlight something about the type of projects that may qualify for carbon credits, and possibly talk about also the outlook for inter-country trading. Thank you. See you.
Thank you. And yes, thanks for having me. And thanks to Sean for a great intro there in terms of the sort of breadth of the carbon market. I think I don't disagree with anything that's been said so far. It's a market that's been going for, you know, more than 20 years, and it's evolved significantly over that period and continues to do so. In fact, you know, I think that one of the things that is often misunderstood with this market is that there is a huge amount of experience and trial and error that's taken place over that period that we're building on constantly. And it's great to see with the growth in interest in this market, a range of new companies and organizations and actors coming into the market in terms of the sort of roles that could be played. And it's, you know, similarly in terms of the work that London Stock Exchange Group is playing you know, maybe 4 years ago, it would have been surprising to think that we would be playing an active role in the carbon markets. And it's a testament to the growth in interest from the corporates, but also the investor community in this market that we're playing an active role now, as well as many other financial institutions. A lot of the challenges we've heard about so far are on the side of the supply side, in terms of making sure that activities that take place have integrity in terms of the ton of carbon, and various different accounting methodologies and processes that sit around those exist, managed by the standards bodies. And there are, you know, maybe half a dozen of those that are treated as credible in this market. They take different approaches, but fundamentally what they all try to do is ensure that projects have a process and a workflow for design, implementation, ongoing management, and carbon accounting of the emission reductions or removals that are taking place. And that's a really important role. What we see at the moment is a lot of confusion in terms of how those activities differ and how, on a project level basis, we can ensure that integrity exists over time, bearing in mind that a lot of these projects take place over, in some cases, decades. And so during the period of lifetime of a project, we're going to see changes in technologies, advances in the way that we measure and ensure that and measure the emission reductions or removals that have taken place. I think that's some of what we're seeing right now, is the innovation of the earlier stages of land use projects in particular, that has enabled billions of dollars to be channeled into them, is now being reviewed in the light of access to far better quality satellite data at an affordable price than ever used to exist. And so, you know, it's great to see that coming in, but I think we need to sort of not forget that this is innovation that's taken place over a long period of time. That being said, it is a challenging buy side, right? So if you're a buyer in this market, it is a really difficult market to understand. You have to develop a lot of expertise, and there are plenty of people who will support you in doing that. But what we see really is, you know, challenges if you're a corporate, is understanding how offsetting plays a role within your wider net zero strategy, where that should fit, and concerns around, you know, the sorts of claims that can be made. Then there's the process of selecting the strategy in terms of the types of projects you want to support, and the associated benefits in terms of social impacts and environmental co-benefits that take place alongside these, versus a kind of alignment with business interests or activities. And then once you've done that, the challenge is actually procuring. So the next piece issue really for an organization that is typically buying from a sustainability budget or a marketing budget is buying what isn't, you know, it is an environmental commodity, is not a normal activity for those types of individuals and functions within businesses. And so the market is a challenging place to procure from. So you have a fragmented set of advisors and brokers, some marketplaces, and you've got to navigate those and understand how to implement your strategy within that. So, you know, we can certainly see, and we saw this when we were looking at the markets from the perspective of our listed companies, many of whom are either actively or considering engaging in offsetting. And, you know, the feedback we had was that it's a really challenging marketplace to procure in, and their concerns, not only about the project integrity, but also about whether they're getting good value, and indeed how much of the value that they're paying away is going on, is actually reaching the projects on the ground. So a lot that needs to be done, and the integrity committee for the VCM is trying to work on a lot of that by creating greater transparency on the transacting of credits, greater or more common views of governance around the different standards bodies and methodologies. What we have chosen to do, and Cathy will talk in more depth about the implication of funds in this market, is really look at the supply side. If the market is to scale to the sort of levels that Sean was talking about, and I would agree that I think those trade figures are reasonable, then we are going to have to see a huge amount of capital invested into new projects. And if you're going to have capital at that scale going into projects, then investors need to have confidence in the process. So right now, and typically, until very recently, the projects were developed on a merchant basis. So an organization with access to capital to invest on the ground, maybe co-investing with NGOs or civil society groups, would undertake a project with a view that they would sell credits on the open market when they were generated and generate a return. That's fine for a small market, but what you need is much longer term thinking and larger scale capital. And that means investments of millions and indeed billions of dollars upfront going into projects that will yield credits over the next 20, 30, 40 years. You know, we talk about net zero by 2050 as a sort of ambition, but the reality is we'll still be having emissions that need to be compensated for even at that point. That's why it's called net zero. So really what we looked at from the stock exchange perspective to start with is, rather than think about the trading part of the market, which is increasingly well served, although thinly traded still, we need to look at how capital gets into these projects and how to make an investment grade structure for institutional investors and for corporates who want to access credits for the long-term commitments that they're making. And we looked at some of the examples around green infrastructure, which has many parallels with the carbon markets, in fact, it's exact parallels in some cases with the same sorts of projects. And the ability of investment trusts to raise capital to deploy into these illiquid assets on the ground. What we felt was the listing rules that exist are fit for purpose for those understood sectors, but for the VCM, where there is this sort of lack of confidence around the process, and certainly lack of understanding, the skill sets in this market are still few and far between, that we needed to create some additional rules that would create confidence in the process. So both what the plans were, the expertise of the organizations undertaking projects, the approach they're taking to risk management, some guardrails around the standards bodies that they're using whilst leaving room for some innovation, and then ongoing disclosures that allow investors to understand what's taking place in real time and whether any material changes to that are taking place. And that sits alongside and it complements the existing market ecosystem. So it doesn't replace the roles of the standards bodies, and indeed it relies on those to do their jobs effectively, but it adds an additional demand for good due diligence up front and on an ongoing basis. So it requires a greater level of transparency from the project developers to the market that is in short supply currently. And by creating a mechanism that allows that, we can ensure that investors see a bigger picture of the market. They can invest in vehicles that have daily liquidity and therefore can change their exposure if their needs change or if they see both whether positive or negative signals from the projects that they're investing through these vehicles. And that in turn will drive better discipline amongst the project developers. So we think that will really help the market grow. And Cathy will talk in more detail about what that specifically looks like. In terms of the types of projects you can undertake, as Sean said, you know, this really sits across all geographies. Predominantly, these projects are in the global south still. And as such, carbon markets provide a really vital financing tools into these regions. You know, it's a region in which capital investment does not happen at the scale it needs to, generally. And so when we add decarbonisation and the urgency around that, tools like carbon markets and carbon finance are incredibly powerful at getting money onto the ground and putting infrastructure in place that will benefit both the planet, but also the local communities. The global nature of it. And then you've also got a wide variety of activities from, you know, energy efficiency and community scale projects through to land use and indeed new technologies around carbon removals. So again, from a buyer's perspective or an investor's perspective, the ability to allocate a proportion of your offset spend to different technologies and different approaches is really quite a powerful way of deploying that capital and also spreading risk, again, through an investment vehicle that is going to yield credits over time. That's particularly important. I think in terms of the stakeholders, clearly what you've got is a set of corporates who are, in most cases now, very proactively looking at how they decarbonize their own business. And this provides an opportunity to invest beyond their value chains to address unavoidable emissions. But actually, let's look at the stakeholders on the other side of this, which is the communities in which these projects take place. What you're talking about here in most cases is investments that are taking place in communities on the ground, either in forest communities or in communities in parts of Africa that have very little access to energy and clean water. And these projects provide those services to those communities. So we see that alongside carbon emission avoidance and removal projects, we see tremendous co-benefits that take place alongside those in terms of improvements in health, improvements in economic activity, and indeed in terms of engagement with their local environment, because they see it as a source of wealth, not a source of another cost to the livelihoods. So we see some tremendous change on the ground. We did some research when I was at the Gold Standard a number of years ago, looking at the economic value created outside, in addition to carbon benefits. And we took, there was one project, which is a cookstove project in China, and EY did some research that looked at that. And for every $10 per ton that was being paid for carbon at that point in time from that project, it was delivering $100 in economic benefits beyond that in terms of livelihood improvements and environmental improvements. So we see incredible leverage effect in the way that those projects can work. But we need to get the money on the ground to also make that happen.
Thank you, Ajahn. Very, very interesting and very impressive. Katia, maybe as Ajahn mentioned, you could go a bit more into detail about the voluntary carbon markets that you have been one of the key person behind, and especially maybe its role in improving in the transparency and credibility of the carbon markets.
Thanks, Barbara, and thanks to Sean and Adrian for their deep insights. I think there is no question that the entire finance ecosystem is seeking for ways to innovate to tackle climate change, and exchanges here are no exception. London Stock Exchange is a 300-year-old institution, but we continue to continuously innovate to meet the needs of our stakeholders in its broadest possible sense, in pursuit of our mission to be a true enabler of sustainable growth. So voluntary carbon market that we've launched is one of such stakeholder-driven innovations. We see multiple exchanges now facilitating the trading of carbon credits in the secondary markets, but that does not solve the problem of access to capital for climate change mitigation projects, many of which are based in emerging markets. So to date, the sources of financing have been limited, and also to date, these projects have had no pathway into international equity markets and limited access to large investors. And there are good reasons for that, because large investors need a liquid, scaled, and transparent enough market to participate in. But how can there be a liquid, scaled, and transparent enough market when there are not enough projects that gain access to the capital they need in order to thrive and produce new carbon credits? So that's that was behind our conclusion that the solution to the problem starts with scaling of the supply side of the market. And that was indeed the outcome of our participation in Mark Carney's task force for scaling of the voluntary carbon market. So we at COP26 expressed our commitment to use our power and resources to solve the riddle of access to capital and shape our capital market solution, for which we convened a group of experts, both from the VCM ecosystem and from the equity capital markets ecosystem, to help shape the draft market rules that we have put through a market consultation. And in October, long story short, we became the first exchange to enable the listing and capital raising of both funds and companies under the newly launched VCM designation that intend to channel the capital they raise into carbon credit generating projects. I think Adrian has mentioned a few characteristics of our listed funds market that make it immediately suitable as a conduit of capital into climate change mitigation. Our funds have scale, and in fact, this is the largest such platform in the world for closed-ended funds. And they importantly have long-term investors tracking our propositions, and that mirrors the capital needs of climate change mitigation projects. And also one of the key reasons investors track our listed funds is exposure to alternative assets. So non-listed equity exposure, exposure to illiquid and difficult to reach assets, and much of the green propositions that we've launched have had their own investor following. It's also due to the ability of funds to scale after the IPO, which is accomplished through further issuances of shares once new assets are identified for acquisitions, and provided a robust track record with investors is established and upheld. And then finally, it's our flexibility to host both household names and new entrants with truly unique and differentiated strategies. So this newly launched VCM designation adds another type of assets that can be held in the underlying portfolios of our listed funds. These are the voluntary carbon credit generating assets, both nature-based, tech-led, that can either be the focus of the entire portfolio, or they can constitute a part of a broader portfolio of climate-aligned assets. And the carbon credits that are arising and flow through the listed entity, they can be distributed to shareholders as dividends in specie, or they can be retired on behalf of the shareholders, which is very useful for the corporate investor, or sold and distributed as cash. So the key question on everybody's mind these days is how will the quality and credibility be upheld? And here we have procured multiple layers in our approach. Firstly, leveraging the existing market infrastructure, the regulatory framework for both admission and ongoing disclosure. So new entities under the VCM designation will have to go through the same admission process that all our other issuers go through. However, with an extra application for the VCM designation, which we'll discuss in case of a fund, its investment policy, its overall portfolio, the percentage of carbon credit projects in it, the expected carbon credit yield and risk factors. And then on an ongoing basis, our VCM issuers, both funds and companies, will have to issue the standard required disclosure plus disclosure related to the performance of carbon projects. And that ongoing disclosure will be subject to the market abuse regulation, which provides a further degree of investor protection. And then projects themselves, they will have to, of course, disclose which of the qualifying body standards they will be reporting against. In our rules, we have procured both ICROA and ICVCM. And the projects will benefit from the asset stewardship activities of the listed funds. That will be governed in turn by what's been an evolving best practice, the fully independent board, which ensures the implementation of the stated investment policy in the interest of the shareholders. So this is how a regulatory framework of our exchange is deployed to catalyze long-term capital at scale into carbon projects and is set to add the much needed transparency into this market. So as you can see, this is not a solution to facilitate the secondary market liquidity, but rather it's seeking to unlock the flow of primary capital. And then a few words on investors. Of course, on the institutional side, this will be of interest to impact investors and those investors who are seeking to otherwise offset the carbon footprint of their portfolios. And have to date been seeking for ways to participate in this growing asset class. However, the important part will be played by the corporate investors, and that is, of course, driven by the growing expectations to set ambitious net zero targets and demonstrate to the investors and stakeholders that corporates are on track towards meeting the final net zero targets and the interim objectives that are just around the corner in 2030. And it's also aided by the recognition that carbon offsetting is going to form part of a viable net zero transition plan. So our solution is potentially set to change how corporates procure their carbon offsets, which in through this solution, they can access a long-term and predictable stream of carbon credits via exchange listed vehicles, with known pricing, geography, type, and timing of credits. And the corporates can do so and spread the risk in a liquid way, also with the opportunity to adjust their holdings as their offsetting needs change and do so under the public rules, which procure transparency through disclosure. Importantly, this provides an opportunity for a very different type of storytelling, enabling a corporate investor to demonstrate to the market that they're not just buying an offset in a secondary market, but rather deploying their capital to enable new climate change mitigation projects to thrive. So our vision is to hopefully catalyze a whole rich ecosystem of funds investing in and companies investing in such projects and avail a variety of investment propositions to the investors. And in so doing, we're seeking to unlock the flow of capital from large international investors that can benefit the economies in emerging markets.
Thank you, Katya. Thank you very much. And Heather, let's go on to you now. You represent one of the leading carbon credit standards organizations. What differentiates the various standards already operating, and how do you look at carbon credits and you assess their quality? I believe you have some slides if you'd like to share them with us.
I do. Thank you very much. Before I get onto the slide, I do just want to follow on from Sean's comment. And that he was talking about the difference between the voluntary and the compliance markets. Interestingly enough, Sean's from South Africa, and so am I, and we have the carbon tax. And the carbon tax, what that's actually allowed to happen in the marketplace is that you have a compliance system in terms of the tax, and what they've allowed is the voluntary carbon market in underneath that. So for an offset, you use an international standard credit, which would be gold standard, CDM, or VERA. And effectively, what the government is like, can do in that situation is that if a company had to pay 144 Rand tax for a ton of carbon, it would be likely that they would offset it at a slightly lower price. So if it was 80% and that's $9, they might buy the tax, the benefit to the carbon offset for $7. And whilst that's low in terms of what Sean's saying, and we should be looking at $40 perhaps as a minimum, the government now has control over that, and that they can, and they have by 2025, when the carbon tax second phase kicks in, it'll be $20 a ton. And then in 2030, it'll be $30 a ton. So that allows them to set a price, and that sends a very positive signal to the marketplace. The problem with that, of course, is that, you know, that then how do you add the value of the co-benefits on top of that? You know, if you have an SD Vista label or a CCB label attached to that. And you should not just all sort of bundle them all in one price, but that does give some power. So I do just want to also just share my screen, taking on from that. Just be with me.
Thank you.
Can you see the screen?
Yes, yes, we can.
So what I wanted to just mention was just quickly is what VERA would consider in terms of what would look at. Partly, can you see the slide? Yeah. Okay, so partly one of the risks that Sean mentioned was the backlog with the standards. That's obviously an issue in terms of us expecting the number of projects to come in. We had 2,000 projects at the end of 2021, and then last year alone, we got another 2,000 projects coming through the door. So that creates a risk in terms of us, and I can just talk to some of the things that VERA is doing to address that. And also what makes a good carbon credit. So I'm talking specifically from a VERA perspective. I'm not talking from the other standards perspectives. So we feel that these are the issue, the key pillars that stand up and make a good credit. And I think the ICVCM is looking at a similar kind of thing. First, they need to be real. So in the old days, when you had the CDM projects, you know, when some guy said he'd planted a forest, when you sent the auditors to site, not a tree was anywhere to be seen. These days with satellite imagery, drones, it's going to be a lot more difficult for a project developer to get away with that. It has to be measurable. And by measurable, I mean, I'm talking like if you had a waste site and the methane was going into the atmosphere, and now you put a cap on it, you are obviously looking at pressure. So you need to release the pressure. You're looking at flaring rates, flows through pipes, kilometers driven by trucks, if that's converted to another form of energy. And those measurements are all auditable, and they would also be part of a methodology. The methodologies which underpin a standard would all be ISO 14064 approved. So they are at an international standard. Those methods, they take up to 2 years to develop. At the moment, interestingly enough, I think there's about 60 methodologies in the VERA registry. We can use CDM methodologies. There's another 100 there, but there are over 60 methodologies coming through the door right now, which is another way of indicating how interesting the market is growing. Clearly, they need to be permanent. So that's something that we would check in a project. You can't just do a waste site and then in a few years' time, you know, the government comes along and says they want their land back. Additionality, obviously, that's part of the issue, is that without the additional finance, that project would not have happened. And then we use the system of auditors, VVBs, we call them, validation verification bodies. They are accredited to ISO 14065. So again, it's an international standard. They then also have to do some training with Vera, and they have to be an IAF member so that we can know that these things are tracked and the auditor would go to site. The credits also need to be transparently listed on our registry. And clearly there was issues, I think, early days of CDM hacked. These days, they're a lot more secure. Credits need to be uniquely numbered so that we know that there's no double counting, because that's another issue that is a risk in the marketplace. For us, what's important is that we can label those numbers. So it basically, a credit is a series of numbers like on a banknote. And then at the end, you could have a one or a two if it is a CCB or an SD Vista label or a Corsia label attached to it. So Vera not only has the carbon standard, but we have a plastic standard. So you can get a credit for a ton of plastic removed out of the environment. And then the SD Vista means you can measure your project against the 17 United Nations goals, and you can label your project with that particular standard. And we are looking at developing that as an asset. So in other words, you could get an SD Vista asset, which is not tied specifically to a carbon credit, which is another standard that Vera is developing, which people in the ESG space might be interested in. And then clearly they need to be conservatively estimated. So those are in terms of what makes a good credit. And we believe that a lot of those principles are being upheld through the ICBCM. This slide is just to show you and give some sort of confidence to the marketplace is that there is a whole cycle. I think also once again that Adrian mentioned that a project would go through. So a project would select the methodologies, which, as I've said to you, is a whole scientific way of your greenhouse gas accounting. In the case of the waste site, you're looking at flow rates, you're looking at flaring rates, and there's a whole process and procedure under ISO, which says how you convert that into a ton of carbon. And that takes 2 years to develop those methodologies. Your project then gets reviewed by Vera. It goes through a listing and a registration process, which, as I said, goes through the VVB, the Vera review, before it gets registered on the registry. Then later on, you have your monitoring process. So during this registration process, just some of what Vera is doing is we are digitizing the methodologies. So if you submit your project, in the end, you would be able to submit it by putting in the data. So for example, if you had a cook stove project and you submitted that to us and you told us you were getting 1,000 tons per year on the cook stove, immediately that would get kicked out because we know you've got a range of between 0 and 10. So we're using AI and basically the digitization to be able to process projects quicker, because you can only submit a project when the math is correct and when all the data is included. So it will save us time in terms of accuracy and correctness checks, because we don't want to see your project three times. I can guarantee that. We're quite happy to, if it's correct, pass it on through the process. The VVBs will have access to that, and then your project's registered. So registration will happen a lot quicker, because I think one of the concerns is the marketplace is how long it takes. And obviously people are wanting to see some sort of revenue right up front. The monitoring stage, this is the issuance stage. So this is when you've said my wind farm's up, Heather, now we're going to start monitoring it. You know, we're going to start running. At this stage, what we're looking at is DMVR, digital monitoring verification. So with the advent of apps, you know, we can know exactly where the rice paddies are. We know exactly where the cook stoves are. And this allows us to start looking at platforms, which is what Vera is doing. So we won't approve a specific project, but we will approve a platform. So perhaps for a wind farm, you might be looking at saying, okay, it only has to be class 1 meters and they have to be Ulster meters before we'll accept that information coming in. And that information then would feed in the monitoring, which allows us a much quicker process in terms of issuance and the data coming in. So digitization, I think, is pretty key in terms of us reducing and ensuring the quality of the data as long as those checks and balances are in place. And then, of course, we've got the third party verification here. So I think that's key in terms of us going forward, is just all these checks and balances. And I think what you need to understand is from the beginning of the methodology selection right the way to the final issuances, if you look at all the checklists that a project has to go through, what I'm told is that it goes on to almost 500 checks. So a project will go through all of those ticks, and that's what's slowing the process down. So we need to make sure that we can do that as efficiently as possible to assist people to be able to realize that that project and the finances that come associated with that come quickly. So I think that's about all from my side in terms of the what we can offer in terms of quality of credits. Thank you.
Let me stop. Thank you, Heather. Fantastic. Thank you. Amazing how many checks you go through for a single project. Now, a question to all of you before we move on to the Q&A. As you know, the Alliance focuses on emerging markets. So what is your view on the status of carbon trading in emerging markets? I mean, Heather has already mentioned the South Africa case with the carbon tax. Do you see many credits traded that are linked to projects in developing countries? And are there any specific obstacle you can think? Please, Sean. You can start. Thank you.
Yeah, just very briefly. So we just finished up a review of carbon market activity for a client on continental Southern Africa. And without a doubt, it's not a heavily populated landscape. There are niche market actors, which is great. But for a client like the type of client we have, which is where they want to develop a portfolio, you know, they want to look at avoided grassland conversion, they want to do some improved forest management, or they want to do some ag carbon. It's very difficult to find full service carbon developers active. There's a handful of them in Africa. And so in emerging markets, we have firsthand experience of this sort of bottleneck. There are many companies in the US, for example, who do want to come into these emerging markets and play a role, but they just don't have enough presence on the ground. Thank you.
Yeah, I'd add to that. I think it's absolutely right. The market is scaling up rapidly, but it's been a cottage industry for many years. And so the ability to scale up the expertise that is needed, both sort of scientific and on the ground local expertise, is you know, is part of the challenge of scaling these markets. What we think is that, you know, I would say that the opportunity for putting finance into emerging markets is huge. Most of the current projects are based there. And it would be a real shame to see that dynamic shift too much, because, as I say, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit in countries where you can transform livelihoods, but also, you know, significantly reduce both current and projected future emissions. So again, this comes down to how much capital you can deploy and the types of organizations that are doing it. So by creating structures that are able to deploy significant amounts of capital over time with a combination of patient investors from impact investors and corporates who are simply looking for the carbon yield, alongside institutional investors who are looking for exposure to this asset class, we think that will start to really drive capacity building. I think the other thing that will be really helpful, and we are seeing this, as was mentioned, in South Africa and other countries, is governments are starting to understand that this is a revenue opportunity for them. You know, carbon stocks in a forest nation have significant value based upon these types of market. And as soon as governments understand that, they are starting to think about how they will ensure that they get a fair share of the revenues that are being generated. Right now, there's really no regulation around what a project developer does on the ground and the value that they receive in terms of carbon credits. Clearly, there's value going into the ground and within the community they're receiving new products and services or improving their environment. But beyond that, there could be significant value that's being traded away. And so governments are now understanding that. They're seeing how this aligns with their Paris Agreement commitments. And I think, again, that will create new industries, hopefully within these countries, around supporting, engaging and building capacity in incredible projects.
I think I have to agree with that, in that capacity is key. I think if you have a look at not only at developing projects, one of the things that Vera is looking at is building up capacity of VVBs, auditors. So if we're processing projects as fast as possible, then what's going to happen if there's a logjam with the auditors? So that's another area that there needs to be some sort of expertise that is a little bit of a risk at this stage. And then I think the other key area is policy environment, which was alluded to in terms of government, is that I was up in Kenya last week and they're just talking about a carbon tax, but it took me a little while to figure out that the tax that they're considering is that if they become very good at developing carbon projects, they want to export those carbon credits, and then they will charge a tax on the carbon credit that gets exported. But they haven't kind of maybe looked at, you know, what's going on at home. Whereas in South Africa, we're saying, let's have a look at what our carbon footprint is. Let's target and tax entities that are, you know, not changing their behavior. And of course, it's easy in South Africa to target industry because, you know, the poor old cement and steel industries got nailed initially, and then it will roll out eventually to the agricultural and the transportation section. But we'd get to the point where in South Africa, we understand our carbon footprint, so it could move towards an EUDS type of model once we understand that in more detail. But policy, I think, is also key and possibly a stumbling block to answer your question, Barbara.
Perhaps I would also add that the building capacity has to go hand in hand with building and establishing credibility. And that's why we're passionate about capital markets. Of course, we have to be. We're the London Stock Exchange. Yes, policy and regulation is a critical tool, but one should not underestimate the power of asset stewardship, the power of investor engagement. And forward-looking companies in the corporate universe, they use investors as a tool for self-improvement, not just as a source of capital, and it should be no different for the VCM type assets. So I think that through building robust, regular, and transparent reporting, engaging proactively with investors, I think that that credibility will be on the right path.
Thank you, Katya. Thank you very much. We have a few questions from the audience, so I'm going to now start with those. First one is talking about the different carbon credits, e.g. RE, replanting, etc. Can you share some insights on the different demands from different types of investors? Do we see investors from Europe prefer different types of carbon credit as compared to investors from Asia? Who would like to have a go at that?
I can talk a little to that. I think we talk about investors right now, we're still mostly talking about corporates who are buyers for their own use, rather than investors for kind of exposure. So just to clarify that point. And what we see is a, I think largely due to the lack of, in some cases, understanding or general a concern about exposure to any particular project type, we see a lot of projects investing in portfolios of offsets that will cover different types of activity, so that they are not exposed to a single project or a single particular type of methodology that might be criticized. And I think that makes a lot of sense in this current market. We see others who are say maybe more sophisticated who will align their purchases with a particular region that they may have, you know, that sort of maps their geographical presence in terms of their business, or with a sort of something that will fit alongside their, you know, align with their business, whether that's technology oriented or communities, et cetera. So we sort of see very different approaches to the way that projects are supported. In terms of whether that differs by region, I would say largely not. And I say that because the biggest demand side comes from Europe still. The US is growing significantly, but it's much smaller in Asia and obviously in other emerging markets, they tend to be more a supply side country. So on that basis, we see a common focus on integrity, on alignment, as I talked about, with business, more than a particular preference of projects. And I think to the extent there's a preference on project types, it tends to fall into one of two categories, either land use and forest, because it's easily communicatable. So people can understand what a tree is and that it sequesters CO2. So if you're communicating to your end customers, that's a clearer message. And then in terms of the really high impact community projects around cook stoves, again, we see others with a preference for that because it's the narrative around this is very strong. The co-benefits are very strong. And so it's from a communication perspective, it's made much simpler. I think as investors start to come into this market in the sense of institutional investors, they will be interested in yield. So they will be interested in what is the likely revenue that is going to be generated from these credits. So there'll be a shift towards, one would expect, higher quality that will command a premium and higher volume projects. But they're going to have to follow, you know, the kind of the corporate demand side, because ultimately the corporates are the buyers. Maybe there'll be some focus on some arbitrage within regions where there may be additional sources of demand, by which I mean, we talk about South Africa, there is an opportunity to sell into the domestic market for a policy-driven purchase rather than a voluntary purchase. So you've got a sort of double bang for your buck there. You've got a domestic audience, a domestic buy side, as well as a global buy side that's still interested in that country as a source of credits. So that sort of mitigates risk and potentially provides another source of a premium. So I think that's the sort of strategy we'll be seeing going forward.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Another question, more on a practical side. Heather, I think you already answered maybe. It was about whether there was some, it has disappeared. There was some documentation that could be helpful for the investors.
I was just trying to type it in the answer and then I wasn't able to do it, so I apologize.
Okay, it says answer. Okay, so hold on. Okay, is there some documentation or primer to educate the broader investor community on the voluntary carbon markets and ways to consider participating? So maybe Heather, you want to give
it? It's a primer that was put together by Climate Focus, and it kind of it's quite a simple description as to how the offset markets work, buy side, supply side, as a good start. And then from there, there are further references that you can use somewhere else. I mean, I'm sure maybe the panel has other suggestions, but just one that I'm aware of.
Thank you. Anyone else has got any useful documentation that might suggest?
AIDA has a 101 document library, the International Emissions Trading Association, AIDA.org, terrific resource.
Absolutely, and they do a deep dive on all sorts of countries with carbon pricing mechanisms too. So there are countries.
Sorry, can you repeat it again? How is it?
IETA.org.
Okay.
IETA.org.
Okay, IETA.org for everyone. Thank you. And then a question, I guess, for Katja or maybe Adrian and Sean as well. Has a bond-like carbon market ever been considered for VCM-type assets? So on the fixed income side, maybe... Yes, please.
Just very quickly. So last year, one of our clients, who I'm very proud of what they did, American Forest Foundation, issued a green bond it was an inaugural green bond backed by the revenues secured through carbon offtake purchase agreements. And it wasn't very big. It was only 10 million. It was supported and underwritten by JP Morgan. But the point is that it was the first ever green bond issued where they used the revenues from carbon credits. And so we're hoping to expand that whole financing instrument. But Adrian, Katja, go ahead.
No, I was going to say minor but very polite correction, only because the IFC issued a forest bond many years ago. Well, that was the credit one, I think. So.
Yeah, but that was only covering the premium. The IFC one was only covering the premium. This was for full principal and interest. That's why it was different. But yeah, you're right.
Awesome. To the point. I mean, these instruments are, you know, lend themselves to this market very well. You know, particularly if you've got, let's say, the on the fund side, you have you're building in your off-takers. So if you've got investors who are corporates who simply want access to the stream of credits over time, and the ability to hold an instrument on their balance sheet that demonstrates they can meet the commitments they've made, that's one thing. You can combine that with an impact investor that actually wants direct capital to a certain type of activity aligned with the corporates, but doesn't actually want the offtake of the credits, simply wants return of capital. And then institutional investors that want exposure to the asset class. So we think that's quite powerful, and the same can be applied to other bond markets as well.
Yeah, and we foresee that the ecosystem will benefit from a variety of market instruments, just like the corporate ecosystem. However, what we've tried to solve with our VCM solution is unlocking the flow of equity capital. That was an important kind of riddle that we attempted to solve. But in due course, of course, we don't stop there, and we're continuing our work in this space. And by the way, listed funds, they're active users of leverage themselves. So in a way, there is nothing new.
Thank you. Next question is again about the different standards. So there are a certain number of standards and certification. Is it an issue for the VCM market? What solutions do you see in other areas where the multilateral level have a role to play in establishing a level playing field?
I can just say very briefly, it is a great concern, which is why the effort of the Integrity Council for the Voluntary Carbon Market and VCMI on the demand side is so important, because the market is concerned about all these bifurcated, non-homogeneous standards, protocols, methodologies, approaches. And so we collectively as an industry realize the importance that we need to galvanize and harmonize our efforts. So we're trying to do that. And I think both ICPCM and VCMI will make great impact.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, what I'd also say is actually, you know, we've seen the benefit of a private sector approach. I mean, it's an interesting market, because I say private sector and a lot of this is civil society driven, but it's still driven as a market-based approach. And what you see then is, you know, the standards that have been developed over time have addressed particular market needs and focused on new innovations, bringing new innovations. I ran Gold Standard for a while. That focus was really on driving sustainable development as well as alongside the integrity of the carbon, and had a very specific approach, a more onerous approach, but a more specific approach to that piece. Ferry did some amazing work and really pioneered the Red Plus space, as well as then bringing in the kind of CCBA and other kind of add-on standards to this approach. More recently, we've seen standards that have been quite nimble in areas like blockchain and tokenization, which is, I think, from my perspective, a necessary new addition to the market, and a focus on technology-based removals. You know, that if you leave that to one or two organizations, that's going to be achingly slow. And so we need to move at pace. So actually, the ability to innovate with new standards, but to Sean's point, having an ability to kind of, you know, look at the governance of those, ensure that they all have a common interest in the integrity of the ton of carbon underlying, is absolutely vital.
And also where we see the wheel turning is kind of the integration of the VCM ecosystem with the international capital markets, the dialogue, the common solutions, and that will put a stop for the VCM ecosystem existing in silos and will in itself unlock the flow of large institutional and corporate capital into the projects, which is a critical outcome that we're seeking.
I'm just going to add, I agree in that. I think that one of the other key areas is the domestic carbon markets. So you're often seeing standards coming in underneath the international standards, and how do we control and keep and make sure that those qualities is maintained. And then in addition, their registries, how do the registries all talk to each other? And that's also a key piece that we're starting to work on.
Thank you very much, everyone. I'm really sorry the hour has already gone. We should have made this longer. There are a lot of details we should investigate much further in other conversations. So for the audience, we would like to ask you for your valuable feedback. So there is a link in the chat with a post-event survey. Alliance members can access replay of this discussion in our online research library. And anyone else interested in learning more about the Alliance, please let us know. Email us at info@emea.org. Let me thank you, everyone, today. It's been extremely, extremely interesting. And I really hope you also enjoyed the conversation. Thanks.
Thank you. Ciao.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Thank you.